Does culture have an impact on who we view as a good leader in our church community, or how we choose or select leaders? Well, does it? You betcha it does. And that's what we're going to talk about on today's episode of the All Things to All People podcast. Let's get to it. Welcome back to the All Things to All People podcast with Michael Burns. I am Michael Burns, and as always, we are continuing to go through the book, All Things to All People. I guess not as always, because we won't always be going through this book. In fact, we're moving into the final third or something thereabouts, final quarter of the book. I just realized that in the opening, I went about as Midwest as I possibly can. I betrayed the fact that I am from the Midwest by saying, "You betcha." That's in there. I say it sometimes. I even have found myself saying, "Oh," at the end of sentences. And if you're not from the Midwest and you thought I just said, "Oh," as in like O-H as an exclamation, you're wrong. I said ope, O-P-E. And you don't even realize you're saying it until other people point it out. And then you're like, ope. You do say it. And even sometimes A at the end of sentences. I'm like, you know, it's warm outside today. And I say that too. So I'm very Midwest, I admit it. So today, we're going to talk about the impact that culture has on leadership and how we view and select leaders and, you know, all that sort of ministry folks and that whole area. And if you're sitting there thinking like, man, you're making it seem like culture impacts almost every aspect of church life and what we do, then bingo, now you're starting to get it. It really does. And I'm not trying to find a boogeyman behind every bush or, over-exaggerate or overblow this topic, but culture really does influence almost everything we do. And so it makes sense that it's going to have an impact in almost every aspect of church life. And there's just so much in life, but especially in church life, and particularly in a diverse church life, that we're just going to miss if we don't understand the role that culture can have and start to be culturally competent and continue to work towards cultural humility. We will have conflicts that we don't understand the cause of. We'll have, conflicts that we can't seem to resolve that continue to go on. We'll have these weird feelings that something's just not right, or it just doesn't work, or I just can't click with that person and I don't know why. That's not to say that if you read this book or, you know, something on culture, or you listen to this podcast, that boom, suddenly all the conflicts in your life will go away. That's just not how life works, unfortunately. But you will start to have, I think, an awareness of how to at least begin to approach what might be going on and begin to do the work. And sometimes it's still really challenging, and it can take years and years and years. And as I've pointed out, my wife and I have been together now for over 25 years, and we still have cultural issues and conflicts that we have to work out. And sometimes we discover new ones, and a lot of times it's these old ones that we just continue to have to negotiate and communicate through and bear with one another and interpret and all of those things. So let's get in today here. The chapter that we're going to look at is chapter 20, Feeding the Sheep. And let's jump through this and see what we can come up with today. If you were ever to come visit our house, You might not notice at first, but our front door is not fully operational. It's been like that since we moved here almost 3 years ago. In fact, the handle doesn't really work. It's supposed to have a little lever that you push down with your thumb, which unlatches it, and then you can push the door open. But that lever has never worked. And because that lever doesn't work, neither does the lock on the front door. There's a deadbolt lock above the handle, and we've just taken to using that to lock the door when we need to. But the proper lock on the handle hasn't worked since we've been here. I should fix it, but I'm not the handiest of guys, and it's never popped up high enough on the radar to get it taken care of. We had a handyman at the house a few months ago working on something else, and I did mention that door. He looked at it and didn't think he knew how to fix it, so that was that in my mind. We don't address the issue. We've just learned to work around it. It's to the point now that we don't even think about it. We've adjusted and moved on, even though it's a less than ideal situation. The truth about our door is simple. It was broken before we got here, but it's not going to fix itself. If we don't take intentional action, it will remain in its broken state. Now, I would like to stop here and report that when I wrote that opening, it was probably about a year and a half ago at least. I don't remember exactly when I wrote this book, but I think it was early 2019 when I wrote that chapter. So that was about a year and a half ago. And I'm happy to report that I have fixed the front door, put a whole new lock and system, and now we got a sweet like digital lock, and you don't even need keys and all of that. Now, I said in here I'm not the handiest of people, but well, let me not lie. I didn't fix the lock. I'm not the handiest of guys, and I didn't fix the lock. The reality is, a really good friend of ours from our church family, Tim Bobby, came over, and he's super handy and just a super lovely guy. One of the just kindest and most generous people you could ever meet. And so he came over one day, and it wasn't an easy fix either. It wasn't like first time, oh, let me just pop this out and pop this in. We had like a metal door, and it's funky, and it's got weird measurements, you know, to certain aspects of it. We had to, again, I exaggerate when I say we. He had to, well, I watched and conversated with him, you know, had to like redo things a couple times and get it to fit, and he finally did. So it's great. So we have a fully functioning front door. But the reality is there's probably five or six things like that around the house that need fixing that I just don't get to. Now, I will say I have fixed a few things. I've learned how to do some things. There's a few things like some little closet door hinges down in the basement that I could fix. I just got to get to that. I haven't gotten to it. And then there's a few things that like our kitchen sink, like when you turn it on, it sort of leaks out of the sides of the faucet itself, the ball joint or whatever, where it goes up and down. And so, you know, it kind of leaks water out either side. And, should I be telling you this? I don't know, but here's the reality of my life. And so rather than fixing it, if you leave it on too long, like water will leak out and then it'll go back behind the sink on the counter, and it'll run down to either side of the counter and then go like way down to other parts of the kitchen counter. And then all of a sudden you have these big pools of water on the counter. And so my fix for that has been to take two kitchen towels and simply leave them folded on either side of the sink on the back so that the water is simply soaked up by the towels. But the point remains the same. We've just learned to live around these things rather than actually deal with them. So that's the reality. So let me read on here. The next section, reflecting the world. What is true of our front door or our kitchen sink is also true when it comes to problems in life. Most of them won't fix themselves, and without action, they will stay at the status quo or get worse. The history of the United States is a mixed bag. there are accomplishments to be admired, and much good that has happened, but there's unquestionably a dark side. My country has a troubling history with its treatment of non-dominant cultures, particularly people of color. This is true from the treatment of indigenous peoples of the First Nations, to mass enslavement of Africans, to segregation and Jim Crow, to Japanese internment camps during World War II, and a disturbing number of other injustices in between and throughout those tragedies. Access to economic opportunities, education, and advancement have been systematically denied people of color consistently throughout U.S. history. This has led to wide gaps between white Americans and many other cultural groups, with African American and Latino folks typically being the hardest hit. Now, I will break in here and say some people at this point might go, come on, there's other factors going on. There's cultural factors and things like that, because not all groups suffer from inequalities or whatever, and they face racism too, like perhaps, say, Asian Americans, and that's true. And or there's some truth to that. Some is how you look at the numbers. But just because groups have faced prejudice does not mean they've faced the same level of treatment, prejudice, and systematic inequity. The two groups that were undoubtedly hit the hardest continuously over and over again have been Native Americans and African Americans. And so those are certainly the groups where you see the biggest gaps, the most, problems economically, and disparities, that's the word I was looking for, the most disparities between white American, those groups, and then followed by Latino Americans. And so there are other extenuating circumstances, but this sort of stuff does play a big factor. This raises a specific problem for many diverse churches. They often have an imbalance in leadership. To put it bluntly, many, although not all diverse churches in the United States, have a higher percentage of white leadership than the white population of those churches would call for. I don't think the reasons for that are all that difficult to discern. Primarily, they are historical and cultural. We will discuss the cultural factors below, but first let's consider the history. Whites have had more access to opportunity in higher education, and that reflects into who is considered ready to step into roles of higher leadership, where education and training are usually valued. In my own diverse family of churches, a lack of elders, evangelists, and teachers who are not white is a consistent problem. It reflects the sins of segregation and denial of opportunity that have faced so many groups throughout American history. This is a big part of what people speak of when they talk about one group having advantages or privileges over another group. It doesn't mean that members of the dominant group haven't had a challenging life at times. It means that their culture or skin color have not been one of the factors making it more difficult. To make matters more complex, some members of the dominant group are so unaccustomed to being led by non-dominant group individuals that they buck against it when confronted by it. However, they will almost always find other reasons to justify their discomfort. Let me stop here and say some may not fully appreciate what I'm going to say, but I believe in my heart that it is true. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've experienced it. I've talked to people. And there it can be a big problem in churches, diverse churches, with white flight. And what I mean by that in this context is when a leader of color, particularly an African-American leader or a black leader, take over a church, all of a sudden, there are all kinds of issues that white folks have. I'm not saying that they are overtly prejudiced, but what I am saying is that I think a big reason for the cause is they are culturally fragile and not used to having to adapt to a different cultural style. Now, there may be some bias in there that they're not aware of, unconscious bias, and it just rubs them the wrong way without realizing it. I think in most cases, there may be some other cases too where they do realize it. But I think in most cases, it's an unconscious bias or just a cultural issue. And they won't ever say that, oh, it's because they are, you know, a person of color or whatever. But there is an issue of white flight. We got to be honest about it, or we're not going to be able to address it and work through a solution. But that's a reality. Back to the reading. What is the church to do? Does it keep reflecting the sins of the society that have resulted in inequities due to its historical denial of groups of people to equal access of opportunities? If the church does decide to address these issues within the church community, how does it go about it? Would that create more injustice and unfairness? The cultural factor in leadership. Does culture play a factor in church leadership issues? By this point in the book, you should be clued into the fact that it absolutely does. What makes a good leader? What are the characteristics to look for? There are certain virtues that would surely be considered universal when it comes to selecting leaders within a community or group, but there are also other characteristics that vary widely between cultural pockets of people. Take a moment to consider the many cultural differences we've talked about up to this point that can cause different assumptions and preferences and other differences in groups of people. Doesn't it seem logical that between those groups, there would be potentially wide gaps in evaluating potential leaders? In a diverse community, the dominant group will most typically have a dominant role in leadership as well. The dynamics of dominant culture then come into play in a huge way. It makes sense that if they're not actively thinking about their community in a deliberately different direction, people will gravitate towards being led by those who share their values, practices, and customs. Leaders who are looking to identify and develop future leaders will discriminate culturally without ever intending anything like discrimination, because they will consider those who share their own cultural traits, even if they're from a different ethnic or cultural group, to have more acceptable qualities than those from different groups that display cultural characteristics that they do not fully understand. Let me stop here and give a really simple example of what I'm saying. If you have a church that is predominantly indirect in its communication, what are the chances that they're going to select a leader who is just brazenly dominant in their cultural background and communication, where people of the direct communicator is going to tend to offend people? And I meant brazenly direct. Just to clear that up. And so the non-dominant culture group is not likely to select a really direct speaking person, because a non-direct group would be so easily put off by that. So there's an example. Let's say, back to the reading, that a church of 500 people is 50% white, 30% black, 15% Latino, and 5% Asian and other groups. It has a staff and eldership group of 16, 14 of whom are white. The church also has 50 small group leaders, 44 of whom are white. When asked about the disparity in small group leadership, the honest answer of the existing church leadership group is that when they look at leadership qualities, those that most exhibit such qualities are those that are chosen. They will contend adamantly that there is no bias or discrimination, and I believe that in most of these situations, there is no intentional bias. Is it possible, though, that at least a few people have been disqualified in the minds of the dominant leadership group from being considered a leader because they were evaluating potential leaders through their own cultural lens? What appears to be leadership to one group of people may not seem like valuable leadership traits to another cultural group. Thus, unintentional bias creeps into and remains in the group until deliberate action is taken. This is not true in all diverse churches, but surely it's a possible factor in some. And there's a fine line between almost an undistinguishable line between cultural preference and unintentional bias. And But it can go beyond culture too. It can get to a point where people have just sort of conditioned, and in the back of their mind, they just have an issue with being led by people of color. And they would never admit it. They would never say, yeah, that's the issue. It's always something else. But, you know, the pattern becomes clear enough that you go, I'm not sure if it is something else, or if you're being honest with yourself at this point. Let's continue on reading. Ability to connect. I met with one young African-American couple in a multi-ethnic church community a few years ago. They were attending the church, but that's about all that could be said for their participation. There were aspects of this diverse community that they understood and appreciated, and aspects that they did not care for. Ultimately, they stayed because they believed that the truth of the gospel was being preached, but they could not be said to have been fully connected into the community. What's interesting is that several other African Americans in the church identified that couple as having the potential to be wonderful leaders, while no one in the existing leadership of the church, none of whom were African American, had recognized that same potential. One of the white leaders had even made numerous attempts to reach out to this couple and get them more involved in the community and family life of the church, but to no avail. In fact, his attempts seemed to have more of an effect of pushing them farther toward the margins than toward the middle. Despite his best efforts, he could not build a connection. Although the church leaders loved the couple and wanted them to be more active in the community, no one in leadership had considered them as future leaders. They could also be jarringly blunt and direct in conversations with others. They could be quite loud and animated, which had the tendency to occasionally intimidate some within the dominant group. The couple was also often frustrated with what they felt was good teaching on the church being a family, but it was teaching that wasn't often backed up with corresponding action. At least, I'll interject here, at least not in their mind and in their opinion. As they voiced complaints about this, it left the existing leaders puzzled, and with few other options in their minds than to conclude that the couple was negative and critical. Eventually, the church hired a staff couple of mixed cultural heritage, but neither was white. Shortly after arriving, they began to build a friendship with this couple. They were able to connect easily with them and saw their potential, so they began to give them responsibilities and roles in the community. On the surface, others had failed to see them as potential leaders because they didn't comport themselves the way that a typical leader might. But they excelled, especially in connecting with younger people, and particularly with younger folks in the non-dominant groups of the church. This new staff couple was able to turn around these amazing disciples and help them become leaders in the community simply because they were able to understand and connect with them culturally and employ their strengths in a culturally competent way within the church. What a loss that might have been had the church not had the foresight to continue to work toward a more diverse staff. What does a leader do? A fellow minister and I once attended the funeral of the mother of a member of our church family. She was African American, and the funeral was held in the mother's African American church. At the beginning of the service, the pastor asked for any attending clergymen to come sit on stage during the service and then preside in prayer at the end. We both sat frozen in our seats, unsure of what to do. Both of us were white and spent all our adult Christian lives in the same faith tradition. This was uncharted territory for us, and we both felt uncomfortable with being treated like a visiting dignitary of some kind, so we stayed right where we sat throughout the service. Afterward, the member of our church introduced us to the pastor who served as the officiant of the funeral. She had known him since she was a little girl and was excited for him to meet us and vice versa. And I'll break in here and say he did a wonderful sermon message, just a brilliant speaker. On hearing that we were ministers, he was visibly disturbed. Why, he wondered, had we not come on stage? He was gracious, but it was obvious that we had offended him. The member of our church was understanding and forgiving, but she easily could have been upset with our violation of this protocol that was so obvious to everyone else there. In retrospect, We should have complied with the cultural expectations and gone up front. It was the expectation of that cultural setting that one of the roles of ministers is as visible community leader. Pastors should always be visible leaders that set the pace and stand out from others so that they know who to look up to and who to imitate. That's not my cultural vision of church leadership, but it is for many folks who come into our fellowship. I can think of another occasion while leading a church in Wisconsin. Two young single men had recently been baptized into our community. They had been nominal Roman Catholics their whole lives. I tried for months to build a friendship with them, but there always seemed to be a barrier that I could not explain. It took quite a while to get to the bottom of it and realize that they were uncomfortable with the idea of being friends with me and treating me like a regular person. They had brought with them expectations of leadership that they had learned from their parish priests growing up, and they felt that as the minister, I should have a certain amount of separation from the congregation and be viewed as spiritually above those that I served. Again, I did not share that assumption. And I'll break in here and say, this is despite the fact that we talked about this, we studied in the scriptures what we believed about not lording it over and not having these positions, and you know, Matthew 23, and they understood it on a sort of cognitive level, they apprehended it, but they never could fully comprehend it fully into their worldview. Back to the reading. Some folks come from the spiritual background of a priest or minister that presides over the congregation and remains somewhat aloof. Some come from a tradition where the pastor serves as a father figure for every person in the body. Is the pastor dad general role model, inspirer, motivator, coach, facilitator, or something else? Some expect leaders to be vulnerable, while others dislike when leaders show weakness or display too much emotions. Some think leaders should lead by example and get their hands dirty, but some perceive this to be poor leadership and think that leaders need to stay out of the fray so that they can more efficiently direct affairs. Some think that the pastor should visit every sick person in the congregation, but many do not have that expectation. I could go on, but you get the point. I'm not suggesting that leaders can be all things to all people in all these situations and meet the expectations of each member of the church. The important element here is to be aware of these things and talk about them as a community. A culturally competent church will regularly talk about the roles and expectations of the leaders and seek to be sensitive to times when a conflict arises that could be caused by differing cultural preferences or assumptions about what leaders should do in general or in specific situations. Let's go to bridging the gap. Cultural misunderstandings between church members can cause rifts and hard feelings, but divides between leaders and members can exponentially increase the likelihood of people feeling disaffected from a church community and even members leaving the church. A lack of cultural competency can be dangerous to a community. But when these same types of disparities involve leaders, it can become far more serious, far more quickly. What's the biblical view? Should churches be intentional about having diverse leadership, or should they just let it happen naturally? That's really what much of this comes down to. In my opinion, the answer to that is clear. If God's family is not intentional about displaying the gathering of the nations at every opportunity, especially in leadership, then it is doomed to reflect the past sins of the society around us. The divisions, the segregation, the denial of equal opportunity, and the imbalance of power that are built into the kingdoms of the world will be baptized into the kingdom and locked in place. The church will be no different from the world. That's simply not good enough. Now, I'm about to, in the book here, go into Acts chapter 6, which I think is relevant. Were I writing this right now today, I would have also included in this section 1 Corinthians 12. I think this is exactly what Paul is dealing with. He's writing a church in Corinth that has mirrored the social divisions of the world, and he's challenging them, particularly when he gets to verses 21 to 26, to not mirror those inequities, to not mirror the status level. Some are honored, some are not, some are considered impressive and powerful and others are weak. Some, you know, there's rich and poor and all these status levels. And he says, we have to, if you just don't do anything, those are going to come right into the church. And then the church is going to look like the world. We have to be aware of these things. And he actually says, give special honor to those without honor. Those who have honor out in society, he says, they don't need special treatment in the church because they already have honor. But those that don't do need it. We need to level the playing field. We need to be intentional about it. That's not favoritism. That's ensuring that the divisions of the world don't mirror themselves right into the church. Now let's get into the reading in Acts chapter 6. It's important to note that the first time we see cultural and ethnic tension in the church in Acts 6 is also the first time we see an intentional transfer of power away from the dominant group. In fact, a case could be made that at almost every opportunity, the church displayed something of an inversion of power from the world surrounding it. As the church was formed in Jerusalem, it was disregarded Galileans rather than impressive Judean leaders who led the way. In Acts 6, important leadership power was transferred from Hebraic Jews to the often marginalized Hellenic Jews. As the gospel spread into the powerful Roman Empire, it was despised Jews who held most of the important leadership roles in a world dominated by Greek and Roman culture. But as the church was established and Jewish leaders were dominating the power grid within the body of Christ, there seems to have been a concerted effort to transfer leadership and influence to Gentiles and include them whenever possible. Whether it's Jesus' diverse group of Jews among the 12 to the multi-ethnic leadership in Antioch, wherever leadership groups are mentioned in the New Testament church, we see diversity. That cannot have just happened without forethought. The kingdom of God should and must lead the way in this. We need to be on the cutting edge of overcoming the past mistakes and inequities of whatever society we are living in, and of developing not just multicultural communities, but diverse and culturally competent leaders to serve in them. Communication and education. Every church should go through the New Testament scriptures together and study the cultural training that Paul and other authors gave to the followers of Christ. It was a major component of education and community life in the first century, and it should be in the churches in the 21st century. Cultural competency classes should be a regular feature for diverse churches. This is not something that can be taught one time at a workshop and then forgotten with the assumption that we now know what we're doing. As new disciples are added to the kingdom, they must be taught how to operate in a multicultural body, but older disciples will need teaching and training at least once a year. Additionally, sermons should consistently include the topics of gathering the nations and being all things to all people. I'm not saying that these things need to be talked about every week and in every lesson, but not too many weeks or months should go by without a refresher. Without that, it will be easy to slip back into worldly patterns and ways of thinking. I believe that if a church is going to achieve and maintain a certain level of success in cultural competency, it will need to require that any leaders, including small group leaders, ministry organizers, ministry staff, deacons, and shepherding and eldership couples, take a course on cultural training and diversity or intercultural communication. There are many options available for this. Many universities offer such courses, as do local community organizations from time to time. There are also online options, and of course, I'm writing this book with the hopes that it will meet some of the needs of many multicultural churches who can use it as a resource for training leaders and members. Let's talk about the dominant group. We would all like to think that every disciple in a diverse church wants diverse leadership. Well, that is largely true. Sadly, it is not an entirely valid statement. Many real-life situations I have observed demonstrate that dominant groups are not always good at being led by non-dominant people. They might be fine initially with individual leaders of a different race or ethnic group, but if things start to change or diversify culturally, many members of the dominant cultural group start to howl or find reasons to leave the church. Let me break in real quick here and say, again, because, these These principles apply, I think, pretty universally to dominant and non-dominant groups, some of the things that we've talked about. And in the context of what I've experienced, most of the time the dominant group in a church is it tends to be the white Western culture. That might not even be the majority, numbers-wise, of the church, but it's still the dominant culture in our society and in many, at least of our family of churches to which I belong. And so that's just the reality. And I've seen situations where you have, say a mixed church, a diverse church, and then for years and years it's had white leaders, and suddenly a black leader comes to lead the church or have the role of evangelist or the most influential role, however you want to word it. And everybody's fine with that until suddenly the culture starts to change. And maybe it starts to feel more African-American in tone and in assumptions and how things are addressed and what sort of things are being talked about from the pulpit and the singing and all that. And all of a sudden people, I have concerns that this is becoming a black church, or, we're not going to appeal to the white folks and all these sorts of things. And it sounds legitimate until you flip it around and go, well, wait a minute, what if the black or Latino members had said that when a white leader was there, sort of imposing the assumptions of a white Western culture? And so you see, we tend to view the dominant culture as a default and don't think about that it's just a culture. And if we switch it, then we suddenly get all nervous and have all these problems. But that shouldn't be the case, because it's not the case, for non-dominant members. So if the culture becomes a little more flavored toward non-dominant, why do the dominant folks tend to have so much problem? Because they tend to not be as culturally competent. And that puts the onus of responsibility on us who are part of the dominant culture to engage in that. Let's go back to the reading here. When all you've ever known is superiority, equality feels like oppression. Because the dominant group is usually unaware that they have a culture that is squeezing everyone else into its mold without education on the topic, they may view any cultural change as an attack on their group. Why are we suddenly bringing worldliness into the church and attacking my culture? They will argue, completely blind to the reality that the church has always operated through cultural expressions. They just didn't notice because the default culture was theirs. And before I read the next paragraph, I'll repeat the sentence at the beginning of this paragraph. When all you've ever known is superiority, equality feels like oppression. Striving toward inclusive leadership and cultural practices is a must for a diverse community. The New York Times recently published an article dealing with what they termed a quiet exodus of black worshipers from white and multiracial churches. I believe that the primary reasons are cultural incompetence and the lack of a solid base of diverse leadership at all levels, not just symbolic levels, that can influence the life, practices, values, beliefs, actions, and, dare I say, culture of the entire church community. The compromise position. We will come to the table with differing expectations of leaders, how they should function, and what kind of authority they should have. We will also have very different backgrounds in how we relate to authority and whether authority figures should be respected simply because they hold a position of leadership, ascribed authority, or because they have earned the right to lead and have shown respect to others, achieved authority. This will vary from church to church, so there's no simple formula here. Churches will do well to consider carefully what their leadership and structural models are, and make opportunities for people to share honest and respectful questions about the leadership or how it operates. Transparency and communication are vital in working toward a common understanding of leadership in a multicultural community. When it comes to having diverse leadership, I don't see much room for compromise as to whether that should be a goal. The only area of compromise is in how long it will take to achieve it. Some churches are already there, and that is wonderful. Many have a long way to go. Understand that this is typically not a quick fix. Simply going out and hiring a couple that adds diversity to your staff or leadership group does not usually solve the problem. Churches that have a diversity deficit need to be willing to take an honest look at why that is. Are they reflecting and perpetuating the historic inequities of the society around them? Has it not been a priority, and so there's been no growth? Is the church located in an area where it's difficult to maintain diversity? Are there things about the church culture that discourage or dissuade non-dominant members from stepping into leadership? These questions and more like them need to be asked and discussed thoroughly to better understand how to move forward. So, in other words, let me say this. If you look around and you have a diverse church, but your leadership is not as diverse, you have to ask some hard questions. And not just staff. That can be easy. Oh, let's hire some ministry staff. And so we'll hire people and we'll make an effort, and now our ministry staff is diverse. That's really good. That's a good start. But what about at the shepherding and elder level? What about at the family group leader level? Those are places, you know, important ministry leadership, you know, roles. These are the places we need to look and consider and say, if there's a disparity, if there's not a good representation, why is that? What is it about the culture of this church that contributes to that? What is it that we have done or not done? Are we simply mirroring the inequities of the culture around us? Or is it something about our culture that's discouraging this, that's making it really unpleasant and just such a tough road to go down that people would just rather not do it? We got to ask some hard questions there. The grace factor. The goal here is to develop racially, ethnically, and culturally diverse leadership groups at every level of church life. If that's a consistent value and central vision for a church body, it will happen. We're not talking about putting people in leadership positions for external qualities or to satisfy some quota. We are talking about valuing diversity and spiritual maturity in leadership without ever compromising or giving up on either area. The goal for the body of Christ should be to have culturally competent leaders. What does that look like? There are at least five important characteristics that leaders should possess in a diverse and competent community. Cultural sensitivity is a must. To be a culturally sensitive community requires culturally competent leaders who understand the basic dynamics of cross-cultural life and communication. They will not necessarily have a thorough knowledge of every culture that might be part of their church, but they will be willing to learn and able to recognize cultural differences and potential church clashes. And they will keep an open eye for such issues without being consumed by them. They will value and be able to encourage diversity of all types in all aspects of their ministry and all areas of church life for which they are responsible. Racial sensitivity is a must. The concept of race is an unbiblical social construct that often serves to divide humans into tribalism. That's true. But the concept of race has existed in our culture for hundreds of years and has become something that we cannot simply ignore or pretend does not impact our congregations. Culturally competent leaders will not simply brush off different racial perspectives or experiences that members of the church family have. They will seek to hear and understand all the different viewpoints, pain, and perspectives present in the church. They will also work to learn about and grasp these issues so that they can educate and occasionally challenge the body when they need to grow in their knowledge or sensitivity to others. Historical knowledge is a must. When Paul ministered to Jews, he understood their history and where they were coming from. That was easy. He was Jewish, after all. But when he ministered to Gentiles, he also understood their history and what they believed and had been through. We cannot simply say that the only job of Christian leaders is to study and interpret the Bible. We must also study and interpret the people and cultures to whom we minister. Competent leaders will not limit themselves to one perspective. They'll push beyond their boundaries and listen to history from multiple perspectives, which will enable them to understand where people have come from, why they are where they are, and how the gospel calls them forward from where they are. I've seen many well-meaning leaders who don't have a clue about how certain events or trends in history have had an impact on situations today and have done real damage to their credibility and the credibility of the gospel they were preaching because of their unwillingness to learn and hear from differing perspectives. I've heard of cases, I'm breaking in here, where, you know, leaders didn't mean it, but used maybe phrases or something from history that were really not okay and insensitive and had a different meaning for different cultures, and just didn't know it, just completely unaware. Now, that can happen from time to time, and if you're called on it, there should be a great deal of humility. And unfortunately, now in some of those situations, I've heard people have shown great humility, but unfortunately, in several cases, people have not. They've kind of doubled down and just not apologized. And, well, I didn't know. And, well, now that I do, my point still stands. No, it's not the time to do that. It's the time to be humble. Continuing with the end of the chapter here, socioeconomic sensitivity is a must. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul chides some of the presumably wealthier members of the congregation for their approach to the Lord's Supper. What it appears was happening was that wealthier members were bringing their own food and drink to the communion meal. Because they had more leisure time, they were arriving early and getting full and even drunk before the hardworking laborers and slaves that were disciples could arrive. Some of these, it seems, did not have the means to bring much food, if any at all. The wealthier members were not being sensitive to the varying economic situations in the body, and Paul told them that when they acted the way they did, they were eating and drinking judgment on themselves. This is serious. We should never show favoritism toward the wealthy, James 2:1-12. But leaders must also understand the perspective of those with lesser financial means. Do we plan expensive events and retreats and then scold members who cannot come? Do we have leadership groups that also reflect the socioeconomic diversity in our communities? Or do they only include the middle class and up? Leaders must set the pace in learning and humility. Paul instructed Timothy to strive after growth and progress to a degree that everyone in the community could see it. 1 Timothy 4:15. Culturally competent communities have culturally competent leaders. In fact, I've never once seen a culturally competent church that had leaders who were impassionate or unconcerned about these issues. But overconfident or disinterested leaders will often think that they're fine, although they have a frustrated and culturally needy congregation behind them. Leaders must show the way forward in their willingness to listen, learn, take classes, and explore other points of view. They need to have vision for their church family and encourage others to have vision as well. I'll say this without hesitation. Every single time that I've seen a church grow and make strides in their cultural diversity and competency, it started with a humble leadership group. Every single time. Well, all right. That's our episode for today. Thanks so much for joining me. If you listen to the podcast and you enjoy it, you know, you made it this far, you've obviously listened to this episode. If you're on Facebook, go ahead and visit our Facebook page, the All Things to All People podcast with Michael Burns on Facebook. If you're not a member of that group, please join in. But go ahead and each Monday when it's released, there's a kind of a little promo ad that goes up for the episode. Please go on there and, you know, leave your thoughts or something that you learned from this episode, or a question related to the episode or something like that. If you have some more general feedback or questions, please feel free to use the email. Let me know how you're doing, how we're doing here with the podcast, if it's helping you or whatever, or ask questions. That the email is allthingstoallpeoplepodcast@gmail.com. And as I've been doing for a while, I'm going to ask you if you've read this book or any of my other three major books that are on Amazon, please go to Amazon and leave a great review there. And that helps the ministry and helps get the word out about the books. Those metrics and reviews of your favorite books or Christian authors really do help in a lot of ways. So thanks so much. Next time, oh boy, we're going to get into the culture gap between generations and why the younger generation is often super frustrated with us older folks and how culture between these generations plays into that and what maybe we can do moving forward. We'll see you next time on the All Things to All People podcast.